The car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Having all of these brilliant people around with a structure that encourages them to collaborate and interact and indeed rewards people for collaborating and interacting makes things happen that might not otherwise happen.
I like to think of it sometimes as scientific autonomy, like you're getting to make more informed, autonomous decisions when you know what's under the hood.
The process of getting different methods to work together to solve a particular problem teaches you an enormous amount that you can't necessarily learn in other ways.
So hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of STEMcast, where we are joined by Professor Andrew Millis, a physics professor at Columbia University and co-director of the Center for Computational Quantum Physics at the Flatiron Institute of the Simons Foundation. Professor Millis is a theoretical physicist with broad interests in the areas of quantum condensed matter physics, is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, received the 2017 Hamburg Prize for Theoretical Physics, and as you can imagine, the list goes on. You can find more information on Professor Millis's background in the show notes. So Professor Millis, I'm so excited to be speaking with you today.
Pleasure to be here.
So as we've mentioned previously, you've had a distinguished career in theoretical physics. So for our life science students listening, could you explain what your research in theoretical condensed matter physics entails? And what's that fundamental mystery that first captured your scientific curiosity?
Yeah, well, I mean, ever since I was a little kid, I was interested in physics, in understanding how things work from fundamental principles. And I work on theoretical condensed matter physics, which is a fancy way of saying solid state physics. But what it's really about, or the part that really interests me, is that it connects the fundamental and fundamentally strange world of quantum mechanics to the world of everyday things and how they behave. Really, the subject starts from understanding why are some things brittle and some things soft? Why do some things conduct electricity? Other things are good insulators. Connecting those things to quantum mechanics is really the question that fascinates me. There's a second aspect of that, which I like to think of as the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. All of the properties we care about, for example, just as a material heart, does it break when you bend it, does it not? These are not properties of an individual atom. You can't say, does an atom break when you bend it? They're properties of the whole material. So how do you get these kind of collective properties out of individual atoms and electrons interacting together? How is the whole different from the sum of its parts? Anyway, so to me, those are the two really big questions that have always fascinated me.
Amazing. And it's the idea of how do these properties emerge, under what conditions perhaps do they emerge, right?
Yes. Yes. How do we understand the way they emerge? Emergence is a big word in my field. I've never really liked it because it reminds me of this old movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And I think of something horrible coming up out of a swamp when you say emergence, but that's a word that people use. The
two things that I really want to understand better are superconductivity, which is, you know, this ability of electrons to flow with absolutely zero resistance, and where it comes from. And how do you optimize it? How do you get it to happen at higher temperatures? How do you get it to carry more current? And there's a whole class of basically new superconductors, which are different from the ones that we understand. And what I really want to know is, where does this come from? Why are they superconducting? And knowing why, how can we use that to make the transition temperature higher? The other set of things, and most of my scientific life has been focused on thinking of what electrons do in just a fixed background of atoms. Mm-hmm. But atoms move, they scatter electrons. How the atoms move affects electronic properties. And so I've become really interested in understanding that better. How does this is the what the jargon electron phonon interactions really means. Just how does the motion of atoms affect the properties that you might care about, whether it's magnetic or not magnetic, superconducting, not superconducting, electrically resistive, not electrically resistive? How do we make a proper theory of and a proper understanding of electrons interacting with moving atoms?
So you spent your career studying how these number, like huge numbers of simple, smaller particles organize themselves into something more complex. What was the journey that led you from that world to co-directing the Center for Computational Quantum Physics at the Flatiron Institute?
I think great good fortune in being in the right place at the right time. Really, the Flatiron, the Simons Foundation was founded quite a long time ago by Jim and Marilyn Simons. Jim Simons was a person who has had really three distinguished careers, first as a mathematician, inventing some of the fundamental concepts that people use now in mathematics and theoretical physics, and then in finance, where he had ideas which led him to found an immensely profitable hedge fund called Renaissance Technology. And as that grew, Jim and Marilyn decided they wanted to give some of their give something back to science and to the scientific community. So they established a foundation. It was first very small. I was not there at the time. The story is it lived in basically a shoebox in Marilyn Simon's dressing table. And as the Simons' resources grew, their ambitions grew, and they eventually established a large-scale foundation. So as this was coming online in its final form, they were looking for people to manage a grants programs in different areas of science. And one area that they had identified was mathematics and physical sciences. So to help set up this grants program, they wanted someone with expertise in theoretical physics, and in particular in areas of theoretical physics different from string theory and things like that, where the Simons already had good connections. Someone who was based in the New York area so they could work part-time and had some both a broad view and some administrative experience, which I did because I happened, among other things, to have been department chair. So when you put all these things together, that was me. So they asked if I would be interested in joining part-time. To my great good fortune, I was sensible enough to say yes. And it's really been a privilege to work with the foundation since 2011, first on setting up their grants program, where I was associate director for physics, working first with David Eisenbud, a distinguished mathematician, who went back to University of California at Berkeley, and then Yuri Chinkel, a equally distinguished mathematician at NYU, in establishing the grants programs in math and theoretical physics and helping to administer them. And then as the Simons financial resources grew, their ambitions grew, and Jim became interested in setting up an in-house research entity. There's again a backstory we can come back to on what led to this. So I was involved with other people in advising Jim on formulating a mission for this institute and a size and scope. And then once it got going, I decided, asked to move from my role as associate director for physics on the grant side to helping run one of the Flatiron units. So that's basically how I got here.
And the Flatiron came to be in 2016. So you really had 5 years in your role at the Simons Foundation to then visualize what the core mission of the Flatiron Institute and later on the CCQ would become, right? Mm-hmm. So I was wondering about their core missions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's go back a step. Simons Foundation itself is a philanthropy devoted to the proposition that basic scientific research can be incredibly valuable for mankind. You know, the world of science is enormous and you have to focus in different areas. And one of the three focus areas that the Simons identified was mathematics and physical sciences. As somebody put it, the theoretical sciences radiating from mathematics. Okay, but the basic idea always was to identify areas which were promising and under-supported, and people who are excellent. And really, one of Jim's trademarks is identifying great people and giving them the resources to do what they need to do. In some ways, the Flatiron Institute grew out of a program that we call the Simons Collaborations, which are groups of, 10 to 15 investigators, typically spread over a wide variety of areas, who are interested in working together on a problem which is important and where there has been some recent development which makes you think that there can be new progress and which is not being adequately supported by the standard funding system. In a way, the Flatiron Institute is that writ large. As we discussed what might be useful and important areas for the Institute to focus on, we concluded that the combination of computation, basic science, and large data sets, that intersection was going to be of rapidly growing importance in science. And it was a thing which was just hard to do right in the university research system as it exists. And in fact, I realize I'm getting out of order here, but if I could take a step back, shortly before I joined the foundation, Jim Simons convened and Marilyn Simons convened a retreat of a group of very distinguished scientists, including physical scientists like David Gross, the winner of the Nobel Prize for asymptotic freedom, Eric Lander, who was one of the founders of genomics, various other people, including Ingrid Dobeschi, who was a mathematician, and among other many distinguished contributions, one of the inventors of the wavelets techniques of mathematical analysis. So Ingrid said at this meeting, I'm told, the area of big data and large-scale computation was going to have an enormous impact on science, and the Simons Foundation should think about supporting it. Right. And it was really that, I think, was the key idea which led Jim first to found something called the Simons Center for Data Analysis, and then which was a small in-house research group directed by a mathematician named Leslie Greengard. And then as that became, it became clear that that was a great success. And as Jim and Marilyn's resources grew, Jim wanted to expand that to the thing that became the Flatiron Institute. So that's a very long-winded answer, but that's how we got here.
So it's really great to see how you've all worked together to identify these like progressive research programs. So for students who are listening and have heard of like Luckatosian research programs, this idea of being progressive or regressive is a very big topic in that. And from what I can tell, you guys have really identified a core that can allow like really big growth. Okay. Shifting a bit, you talked how certain other funding mechanisms might not be able to support the progressive research programs that you guys have identified in a way that can be in a certain way, for example. So you've described yourself being driven by a fundamental curiosity, and many argue that standard academic models with 3 to 5 years of grant funding cycles can sometimes stifle the, blue sky thinking.
I have to say, I'm not completely on board with that. So let's talk about that for a second. I mean, in my experience in the world of, academic grant-supported research and so on, there is quite a lot of blue sky thinking. And the system as a whole has been incredibly successful. Now, it does have some disadvantages. And one of them is the short time horizon of the grant cycle. And it's not so much that it inhibits blue sky thinking, but it inhibits long-term thinking. Because, every couple of years you need to show what you've done so you can get your next grant. And if you think about it, it almost has to be that way. Science is vast. The government support for science the government puts an extremely large amount of money into science. There has to be monitoring and control so that we know the taxpayer dollars are being spent wisely. There has to be something like a relatively short-term grant review to make sure, just to satisfy the government, that things are proceeding correctly. As I say, in my experience, the things that it doesn't support as well as one might like are long-term projects, things that just take longer than a couple of years to mature. And collaborative research. And that's because, if I'm an individual investigator and I have a grant, then I have to show what my grant has accomplished, and it has to be attributable to me so that the reviewers will then decide to give me the next grant. So there's a little bias away from collaboration and a little pressure towards identifying what one does as the latest and greatest thing. And what we discovered first in the framework of Simon's collaborations and then in Spades in the Flatiron is that there are areas where collaboration is essential and where you learn much more by comparing relatively different methods, which involve different approximations, which work in different domains, which have different constraints. And the process of getting different methods to work together to solve a particular problem teaches you an enormous amount that you can't necessarily learn in other ways. And also for hard problems, it gives you much more confidence that you have the right answer if different methods can make a handshake and get the same answer. And the standard grant system tends to push one away from that mode of operating. So we saw it, for example, in something called the Simons Collaboration on the Many Electron Problem, which is a kind of clunky title. But this was an intellectual activity that actually gave rise to the Center for Computational Quantum Physics that I'm involved in now. And it was because the Simons Collaboration structure gave long-term funding to a group of people who all wanted to work together on a common problem. We were able to put the time and effort into making handshakes between several different methods, right? And the process of doing that made each one of them better and led us to collaboration papers which had multiple authors presenting the results of multiple methods on a given problem. I think is crucial to the kind of progress we want to make at Flatiron, and that's the thing which is hardest to do in the usual grant system.
So collaboration and long-term projects, are there other examples that come to mind that you think really showcase the incredible collaboration culture that you think the Simons Foundation and the Flatiron have cultivated?
Yeah. And just to make a digression, one of the really other important things about Flatiron is just the density of people who are here. Each of the centers has, roughly 50 people,
Yeah.
roughly 20 postdocs and so on, roughly 25 or something more permanent staff. The numbers vary from center to center, all packed into a relatively small space. So just having all of these brilliant people around with a structure that encourages them to collaborate and interact, and indeed rewards people for collaborating and interacting, makes things happen that might not otherwise happen. There has been tremendous progress in the area of astrophysics on simulating the early universe and understanding how you go from the Big Bang to the structure of galaxies, stars, clusters of galaxies that we have now, and that this has required collaboration between computer scientists, algorithm people, people who know about the physics of stars and galaxies, people who know about the early universe and quantum cosmology. Putting all that together has taught us a bunch of things that we didn't otherwise know. Another example is work on biophysics of cells. So it turns out, and I'm really out of my personal scientific comfort zone here. Think about processes inside cells, for example, just cell division. Physical forces connected to flow of fluids inside the cell are tremendously important in how that actually happens. And the people in our Center for Computational Biology have learned a tremendous amount about things like the formation of the mitotic spindle and so on from a collaboration that involves experimentalists, and we don't really do experimental work here, so those are people we collaborate with at other institutions. Applied mathematicians who know about partial differential equations and fluid flow, computer scientists who know about discretizing things and putting these things on computers, and biologists who understand the biology going on, right? And it's really the combination of all of those things which has made progress. So that's a couple of examples. If you'll permit me a little bit of jargon, in my world of quantum physics, where superconductivity comes from, the ability of things to carry current with no resistance, right? We now have basically solved the problem of which theoretical models give you superconductivity. And in particular, we know the answer to is something called the Hubbard model, which was written down by John Hubbard in the early 1960s. Does it have superconductivity in it? This has been controversial for years, And it's really by bringing multiple methods together, a combination of neural network-based methods, quantum Monte Carlo, quantum embedding theories, diagrammatic Monte Carlo, bringing all these methods together and demanding that they make a handshake and trusting only results that are given by more than one method in a given regime, has really allowed us to settle that question.
It's so exciting to hear, especially as I've noticed at least a lot of students heading in a direction where they want to be very interdisciplinary, where just in their research themselves, instead of being very, very focused on one, they try to, like, for example, I'm a neuroscience student, but a lot of people like the big term right now is neuro AI, so they do a bit of both. I don't know if at the Flatiron you guys encourage students to be more interdisciplinary or more collaboration from very deep fields on their own.
Well, in fact, Flatiron is, in first instance, not an educational institution, right? So we're not accredited, we can't give degrees. We have various programs to help students find their way here. But really, we're a research entity at the postdoc level and above with some students, right? But that said, I think we all believe that collaboration is crucial and mixing of ideas is crucial. We think it's best if this comes from deep understanding of domain science. What we find really makes progress is having people who are deeply knowledgeable in one scientific domain just get a little bit out of their comfort zone and work with people who are deeply knowledgeable in a different, possibly related scientific domain. Actually, one very interesting example, which is just happening now, our latest center is a thing called the Initiative for Computational Catalysis. You know, that catalysis is basically the science of getting chemical reactions to do what you want. Most of the world's fertilizer is made by catalytically improved reactions. That's what produces nitrogen and fertilizer. Essentially, every chemical thing that is commercial involves a catalyst somewhere. And doing that better is an enormous challenge for the world. Anyway, so we have a center now for computational catalysis, which is combining quantum physics, because chemical reactions involve moving electrons from one place to another to make and break chemical bonds, with all the material structure around it, because these things don't happen unless the atoms are in the right place. So there is a growing collaboration involving machine learning and people from our Center for Computational Biology who've been interested in where atoms move to understand things like structure and dynamics of proteins and cell walls and so on, with the people in the catalysis center who come from a more traditional chemical background. It seems like the things that the biologists know about, as it were, molecular dynamics, the science of how atoms move in complicated environments, is directly relevant to what our catalysis enterprise is doing. And there is developing a very fruitful collaboration between some of those biologists and our catalysis people. So that's an example. More generally, really, you mentioned Leslie Greengard in the Center for Computational Mathematics. And in a certain way, that is the central nervous system of our whole enterprise. This is also a unique feature of Flatiron that we integrate algorithms and computation into our science at a very deep level. And the Center for Computational Mathematics is populated by people who are interested in algorithms and computing, who find interesting math problems in the domain science that we all do, and whose work delivers incredibly much better ways of doing the things that we need to do. So there are some people who are jointly appointed between CCM, the Mathematics Center, and the domain science centers, and there's an enormous amount of give and take and back and forth between that center and all the other cent each of the other centers. Again, that's just because university research is a bit more siloed and a bit more dependent on individual grants. That's one of the things which is hard to do in the university world.
And so, even if you have two researchers working on the two sides of the coin, it's much harder to bring them together and have them, for example, discuss conceptual toolkits that could be shared.
And share a common language, I would say, and a set of common problems. I mean, what really doesn't work is for someone in a domain science to just throw a problem over the wall, you know, into the room of the mathematicians and hope that they will do something about it. Right? That basically never works. You need to be working and talking together on a day-to-day basis. on some topic of common interest that you come at from different perspectives. So it's really that collaborative atmosphere, which is one of the things that makes this place great.
So you mentioned a common language, and in our previous talks, I said that in one of your lectures, you mentioned a quote from Wittgenstein, who said, "Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one cannot do science." That's your reformulation of his original quote, which was in a German, I believe. And so I was wondering what role you guys, as co-directors or managing directors, do in order to facilitate the exchange of conceptual toolkits. Where do you guys fit into this facilitation?
That's the question of scientific management. And really, this has to be done with a very light touch. What we can do is some combination of identifying important areas or problems that might be interesting to work on, hiring the right people who are inclined to be collaborative, and giving people the context to work together. But really, everything good comes from the bottom up and not the top down. What it's all about is finding good people and giving them a context to work with each other and talk to each other.
And so, for example, you said that oftentimes people are just drawn to interesting math problems in their specific domains, and perhaps you can have interesting math problems that apply in two different domains. So that's right, what brings them together.
Yeah, but also I think just having as many venues as possible for scientific interaction and discussion is what brings people together. And as I say, hiring the right people who are motivated to collaborate. And one of the remarkable things about the people in our Center for Computational Mathematics is just that they're open to discussing with people in all of the domain sciences and understanding what they're trying to do, what their problems are, what are the real obstacles that they're encountering. And, then sometimes, that leads to an interesting mathematics problem, and sometimes the solution of that interesting mathematics problem leads to a much better way of doing something.
And if you don't mind me asking, have you had experiences in your academic or professional career where that has occurred?
Yes, in two different ways. One, actually, before the Flatiron, really in technical things about doing so-called quantum Monte Carlo calculations, but we had a rough vision of the kinds of things you would want to do to calculate the properties of many electrons, right? And actually implementing that took extensive discussions with people who were much more trained in computer science than I was. Then I would say not quite in my personal work, but in very closely related work. Again, as it turns out, there are certain things internal to the electron calculations that we want to do, which amount to evaluating integrals of complicated functions. Discussions with mathematicians here have provided enormously better ways of doing that, right? And the challenge of finding these better ways has been stimulating to the mathematicians. And the fact that we can do this has made things go 100 or 1,000 times faster for the same accuracy, which just transforms what you can do. Right. So I could say more, but it would rapidly get very technical, and that may be
Perhaps you can give it a shot, just so some of our listeners get a bit of a taste.
sure. But in a way, I think about all of this as compressing information. If you think of a function that you just draw a curve or something, which may have various wiggles, you could present that function just as a series of points, right? So if you think of a function of something as time, at every microsecond, you could say what the value of the function is. And then if you have something which runs for 10 seconds and you give its value every microsecond, that's 10 million points. That's a lot of points, right? But it may be that there's a simple structure inside that function which allows you to represent it with a small number of things. If I may be technical for a second, one way that does that is Fourier analysis, right? You could decompose it into waves, and there are some things which in fact are a sum of only a relatively small number of waves. Right. So basically, it's that idea in more general concepts is finding the underlying structures which allow you to compactly represent a superficially complicated function.
I mean, we do a lot of that. The word that immediately comes to my mind right now is dimensionality reduction, and you do a lot of that in neuroscience and a lot of other biological sciences. But I see a lot of students, myself included, who very easily use a function, use like a Python library, and kind of don't really try to understand what's going beneath the surface. And I was wondering if students would benefit from trying to not necessarily work at that high level of abstraction, but maybe go a little deeper. What kind of almost courage or skills should we develop to try and go deeper?
Well, that's a very complicated question, which touches on how education should really work and which things you need to know, because there is an infinite number of things you could possibly learn. So you do have to make some choices. But you see, the way I think about mathematics and these other conceptual structures is really like a language. And if you've tried to learn a language which is not your native language, that first you look in a book and you see a whole bunch of complicated and annoying rules which you have to memorize. And then somebody actually talks to you and you try to say something and you feel like a hopeless idiot. Right. And then if you just keep trying to talk, eventually you become more and more fluent and familiar with the language. And at some point you can just talk. Right. And really, the only way to get fluent in a language is not from books, but is to get out there and do it. Right? And in my view, all of this mathematical structure stuff is the same. And the bad thing about much of our education is that most people get stuck at that first stage of like trying to learn a language from a language book instead of talking to somebody. So my feeling is that really one should think about all of this as learning a language. And one should just get out there and do it at whatever level one can. And you're never going to be as eloquent as Dante in Italian, but you can still learn to talk.
You can still learn to talk. And
Actually,
that's.
hard to pick up the basic language of mathematics and physics, right? And it is very useful to know at least a little bit about what's under the hood of these libraries, both so that you can understand when it's making mistakes or leading you in some wrong direction, and to understand when it's not working as well as it should, and you should look for something else.
I like to think of it sometimes as scientific autonomy, like you're getting to make more informed, autonomous decisions when you know what's under the hood. And in my view, that helps us become more creative researchers. If you've come across students who have gone through that leap and tried to learn this new language, albeit it being very difficult initially, thanks to having someone to talk to initially, right?
Yeah. And also remember when I said talk, that's partly a metaphor. I mean, one just has to get out there and do it in the same way that when you're learning a language, really, you just have to get out there and talk to people. But so, I see mostly a pre-selected group of people who are concentrating in physics and related subjects, and who have already learned some of this, typically at a younger age in high school or something before coming to college. But in all of these students, you do see exactly that transition as people move from the freshman year at the beginning to seniors and then graduate students. And it really is a process of just internalizing the language of mathematics and theoretical physics on the level that you need it for your work. Anyway, so I see that all the time. And my regret is that there are many students not in this world, who, as I say, never get past the just looking at the language textbook and memorizing lists of conjugations and things. I realized there was one other thing I wanted to say about the atmosphere here. All right, which relates to something I said before about throwing problems over the wall, and also to the advantage of philanthropic funding. The other really important thing about scientific life here, in addition to just the general feature of collaboration, is in particular the detailed level of collaboration between computer people, software engineers, algorithm designers, coders, and domain scientists. We all work together. Most of these people are directly engaged in scientific research and work together on common problems. Now, in a university, I just could not do that. If I want to hire someone to help me with my computations, or, to maintain the computer system to tell us how to run it and so on, I can get a grant. And then I can say to a person, well, now I have this grant. I can pay you at this government rate, which is typically relatively low, for 3 years. And then I'll try to get another grant. And if I get another grant, then you can have a job for another 3 years. And if not, unfortunately, you're unemployed. Right. And this is just not an attractive proposition to people. And what we can do here is, well, we certainly can't pay people at the level that banks or hedge funds can pay them, but we can give them a stable long-term job, which is close to and connected to science, and which is integrated on a kind of equal footing into our scientific enterprise. And it's this aspect of collaboration between computation across all of its parts and domain science, which really makes this place a pleasure to work in and which is unique. And so the other thing I would say to students is learn about scientific computation as it pertains to your field. Learn about it by doing it. And respect it. It is basic and it's going to be of, it's already important and its importance is only going to grow.
And so, for example, the computer science students who are a bit interested in a lot of different things don't necessarily know where to apply themselves. They develop those, if they get multiple hats and can go into multiple different domains, your kinds of institutions really facilitate almost the tasting of so many different scientific.
Well, yeah, I would look at it actually, if I may, slightly differently. I mean, again, because in my experience, the people who are both really satisfied in their jobs and who really make a contribution are ones who commit to something, but are very open and interactive with other people. It's like what you really want is a core expertise and a core set of methods, problems, questions that's important to you, and a very high degree of openness towards all kinds of related things. But you want to bring a particular expertise to the collaboration. So you need both a collaborative mindset and a particular expertise and focus to bring to it.
And so your view on that whole exploration exploitation trade-off.
Yeah, you have to change with time. And particularly when you're a student, you have to explore a bunch of things so you know what's out there and you know what you want to do. But yeah, at some point you should commit to something and then expect that over the course of your career that will gradually change. Let's say that sorry, I'll be technical for a second. The fundamental theorem of integral calculus says that the integral is you add up a whole bunch of small things and you get something which is not small, right? And that really doesn't work for your career. You add up a whole bunch of small contributions and it adds up to much less than one. You really need to make sure that you found the thing which interests you, but then you need to focus on that and be open to collaboration.
That's a great and I think rather different way of putting it than a lot of other people we've encountered in our undergraduate careers have spelled it out for us. And so I think it's important to have all these different perspectives, especially when considering what you want to sum to one afterward.
You got to explore a bunch of things to know where you want to go, but at some point in your education, typically in your by your second year of graduate school, you should really commit to something.
And so you can bring something to the table both in your collaborations, but also in your own scientific professional fulfillment. Incredible. Okay. And so with that being said, I'd really like to thank you, Professor Millis, for taking the time to join us today on STEMcast.
Thank you very much.
The recording.
Pleasure to talk to you.